several cuts isn't easy. It requires an enormous amount of time and effort, and there are a few ways you can help.
You can donate to Kendra's Community Kitties on their website, kckitties.com. Even a small amount will help pay for medication, spay and neutering procedures, and food and supplies to keep these felines sheltered and healthy in the cold winters or extreme heat of the summer. Because some of these kitties are not socialized, Kendra has committed herself to provide 22 dishes of food with fresh water every day, 365 days a year, to 6 feral colonies. Food prices have increased significantly, so donations of food and money are always...
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine! You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. On today's show, we will start with the U.S. election. As people warned many times before, the Arab American community seems to have turned its back on the Democrats during these latest elections. We will look at what happened and what a Trump presidency means for West Asia. Then we will ask why this genocide against Palestinians was able to happen even while being filmed and is still able to continue today over a year later. Is Israel really unstoppable? How much the decades-long dehumanization of Palestinians and Arabs in the West play a role in normalizing atrocities in the region? We will also look at the role of mainstream media and social media platforms in spreading the Israeli propaganda talking points. Finally, we will come back to Canada and listen to a report about the latest visit to Montreal by the UN Special Rapporteur on the Palestinian Occupied Territories. Francesca Albanese is visiting Canada to remind us to abide by international law. As she said to reporters in Montreal, "I am not imploring to your charity and I'm not appealing to your morale. I'm asking you to respect international law because that is what you are supposed to do." We will hear more about her visit at the end of the show. Stay tuned.
To talk about Donald Trump's election, we want to go to Michigan, where we're joined by Linda Sarsour, a Palestinian-American Muslim organizer, author of We're Not Here to Be Bystanders, co-founder of Empower Action Fund. Yes, Dearborn, the Arab-majority city, Trump won 42% of the vote over Vice President Kamala Harris, who received 36%. Jill Stein received 18%. Stein campaigned calling for an arms embargo against Israel. And I also want to hear what Ralph Nader has to say about this. Linda Sarsour, if you can respond. We spoke to you last night. Now a lot of the results are in. If you can comment on what happened and what a Trump presidency will mean for Israel-Palestine.
I appreciated hearing Ralph Nader's analysis, which I share, and this is all goes to the feet of the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party literally marginalized Arab American, Palestinian, and Muslim American voters. Kamala Harris did not really, make any effort to really win over the votes of these demographics. Kamala Harris continued to parrot the usual talking points about humanitarian aid and about what's happening in Gaza being devastated without any action plan. She was asked many times, would you break from the policies of Joe Biden or in the ways in which Joe Biden has addressed the genocide in Gaza? And she has said no multiple times. Again, Donald Trump engaged in outreach in the Muslim American community. He went and visited mosques. He met with religious leaders. He had billboards all across Dearborn that were multilingual in the language, in Arabic languages, in Bangla, in Urdu. And whether or not people agree with Donald Trump or whether or not, and you know me, Amy, I'm having deja vu of 2016. I was a frontline organizer when Donald Trump was president. So I'm not looking forward to the next 4 years. But the Trump campaign did the outreach. They filled in a gap that was left by the Democratic Party. And all Kamala Harris had to say in this election was, I will uphold international law. I will actually enforce the laws we already have on the books when it comes to military aid to any country violating human rights. But the campaign made a calculation. They made a calculation that they did not need Arab American, Muslim American, and Palestinian American voters, that they can actually win this election without this important electorate. They were too busy courting Liz Cheney and her friends instead of coming to Michigan and actually having deep, courageous conversations with the critics of the Kamala and Biden administration. So this is a devastating moment for our communities. Donald Trump is someone that we know very well. We don't only know him on domestic policy, we know him also on foreign policy. He gave sovereignty to Israel over the Golan Heights. He declared Jerusalem the capital of Israel. There is an Israeli settlement that is named after Donald Trump. His son-in-law, Jared Kushner, believes that Gaza is this beautiful waterfront property. We are in going to be in big trouble. And I blame that solely on the Democratic Party and one of the worst run campaigns that I've seen in my 23 years in organizing.
And Linda, I wanted to ask you something I asked earlier to some of our other guests. There was not a large outpouring of independent votes, but there definitely was a decline in the overall Democratic vote. Kamala Harris apparently gotten 15 million votes less than sleepy Joe Biden did in 2020. I'm wondering what your sense was, that those who stayed home are really a reflection of some of the failures of the Democrats this time around.
Absolutely. And the thing that people don't want to talk about, and as you know, the Democratic Party is not a fan of mine because they don't like to listen to critics who actually are organizers and know how to mobilize communities. Somebody should ask the Democratic Party, how much money did you invest in Black and Brown led organizations who do get out the vote efforts, who engage and build power locally in communities? Somebody needs to ask them that question. They spent a majority of their money on ads, on television ads, and really ignored the grassroots. I was on the ground in Pitt County, North Carolina. I was in Saginaw, Michigan. I was in Dearborn. I went to Georgia, and I did not see the type of field operation that is worthy of our communities. And Joe Biden had the Democratic House, Senate, and White House in his first 2 years, and he couldn't deliver on things like protecting and expanding voting rights. He blamed Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema for being obstacles to his agenda. He couldn't even get two Democrats in line to pass legislation. Lots of women across the country care about things like reproductive rights. Why didn't the Joe Biden administration push Congress to codify Roe? We are in this situation because Democrats want to be in power, but they don't know how to use their power once they are in office. And that is a failure of the party. And the party has to go back to its roots if it wants to move from here. You are either going to be loyal to your base, which majority supported ceasefire and support arms embargo against Israel, that support progressive issues, or you're going to continue to try to recruit a constituency that does not exist, that did not turn out for you in this election. And I hope somebody in the campaign right now is sitting and reflecting on this, and hopefully some people are fired and no longer will be working for the party after this election.
Ralph Nader, you are Lebanese American. We only have a minute, but your response on the issue of the Democratic position, the Biden-Harris position on Israel, Palestine, and Lebanon right now, and what you think has to happen. Because, in fact, the Democrats are in power right now before Trump takes over.
Well, Biden's projecting weakness. There are a lot of voters who want strength, and Trump understands that. And on the Middle East, he's projecting incredible weakness. That's why we call him Bibi Biden and his Secretary of State, Bibi Blinken. He's giving Netanyahu whatever he wants. Daily shipments of deadly weapons of mass destruction, diplomatic cover, veto in the UN, pushing allied countries to get in line. He even refuses to demand that Netanyahu let American reporters in to Gaza to report what's going on. He won't even allow airlifting at the request of American doctors who were over in Gaza, airlifting burned babies and amputee children for treatment in ready and able American hospitals. He is a co-combatant with the genocide that's going on, and Israel's making no bones of this. Netanyahu wants the whole of Palestine, the West Bank, southern Lebanon to the Litani River, and it's all go signal from Biden. So he's projecting weakness here. He is weakly representing the mighty United States of America as if he's an adjunct, a poodle for the Netanyahu regime.
One of the first world leaders to congratulate Donald Trump on his presidential victory was Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. He wrote a message online that read, quote, "Dear Donald and Melania Trump, congratulations on history's greatest comeback. Your historic return to the White House offers a new beginning for America and a powerful recommitment to the great alliance between Israel and America. This is a huge victory. In true friendship, yours, Benjamin and Sarah Netanyahu." We're joined right now by Rami Khoury, Palestinian-American journalist, senior public policy fellow at the American University of Beirut, also a non-resident senior fellow at the Arab Center, Washington, D.C. Rami Khoury, welcome back to Democracy Now! Your response to the Trump victory and what this means for Israel, Palestine, and for Lebanon and beyond.
Role of the Gaza-Israeli plausible genocide, as the International Court of Justice calls it, the role of that plausible genocide by Israel, which was heavily, heavily, enthusiastically, consistently and clearly supported by the United States, clearly had an impact. American people have shown now, as they did when I was in college in the late 60s, that they don't want their country being involved in a great war overseas that kills thousands and thousands of people that doesn't really relate to them. And this is a really powerful lesson. We can't draw the conclusions yet of exactly what the Gaza war did, but it clearly has mobilized a constituency that goes way beyond Arab and Muslim Americans. And I was in Dearborn, Michigan last weekend for 3 days at a convention of Arab Americans. And what I saw was really, really very, very powerful.
But Rami, how do you see the Trump administration changing policy in the Middle East in terms versus what Biden has done in the once it gets into office?
You know, one of the fascinating things about watching this stuff go on for half a century now, as I have, is there are little changes here and there. So last time Trump was in, he recognized Israel's sovereignty over Jerusalem, the annexation of the Golan Heights, he closed the PLO offices, he stopped funding UNRWA, he did all kinds of things that Palestinians don't like and justice supporters don't like and that Israelis like and evangelical right-wing American Christian fanatic supporters of Israel like. He did a lot of these things, and then Biden kept most of them. He didn't change really any of them significantly. And then Biden got involved in this incredible, plausible genocide, and Harris followed him completely. So I don't think there's really much change. Looking back, and empirically speaking, looking back over the last 40, 50 years, there are only minor cosmetic changes between Republican and Democratic administrations. The bottom line that all of them accept, with only the occasional minor adjustment, is that they will do almost anything that Israel wants for many reasons, which we don't have time to get into here, but the American political establishment is fully and enthusiastically supporting Israel, even in its plausible genocide. The American public is not. So there's a moral issue that came out of the American people over the last year and a half. And it was not just Arab Americans and Muslim Americans in Dearborn, Michigan. It was people all over the country, progressive Jews, labor unions, students, the student movement. So this is a movement that is still young. This is like Vietnam anti-war protests in 1965. It took a long time, another 7-8 years, to get the Vietnam War ended. And this is a similar situation. How it impacts Trump is not clear. This is where we have to really wait, because it's very hard to predict what Trump is going to do. He cares about two things. He cares about drama, entertainment, and he cares about making deals. And the deals may be political deals, and they're also commercial deals for him and his family and his cronies and his friends and his supporters. And that's what politicians do all over the world. It's nothing. There's nothing illegal about that. It's just how politics works in superficially democratic societies. But they are democratic, and the vote counts, and new people come to power, and they make deals, and they do dramatic things. Trump out-dramatized Harris, and that's why he won. He appealed to people's emotions, and that's how people vote. They don't vote on, you know, is our democracy threatened? That was a very important line from Harris and all her millions of supporters on the American mainstream television who look like idiots now because they were, not because the message is bad, because the message doesn't resonate with ordinary people all over the country, which is what we saw. So we'll just have to wait and see.
On Saturday, Rami Khoury, the Palestinian youth movement organized a No Votes for Genocide protest. This is Sophie, a student here in New York City.
I'm not voting for the capitalist ruling class, so I'm not voting for either Kamala or Trump. I don't think they do anything for my people. I'm half Bengali. Half of my family are Muslim Bengali immigrants, and they actually experienced their own genocide that was funded by the U.S. And I've never seen any of U.S. presidents do anything for the global south, including Bangladesh, Pakistan, or any of the Middle East. The argument that a vote for Jill Stein or Claudia and Karina or a third party is a vote for Trump is really frustrating. I think it's not a vote for Trump or Kamala. It's a vote for neither of them. And if Kamala loses, it's her own damn fault. You know, like, this is the one thing that's important to me. If she were to do anything for Palestine, I would consider voting for her.
So that was a protest that happened just on Saturday. And I wanted to end, Rami Khoury, by asking you about what happened after President Trump won and he got his congratulations from Benjamin Netanyahu. Just before that, he fired the defense minister, Yoav Gallant, and he installed Israeli Foreign Minister Israel Katz, who proposed creating an artificial island off Gaza's coast where Palestinians could be forcibly relocated. Katz also called for the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians in the occupied territories, saying this is a war on all fronts and we must win it. Are you concerned under Trump that Netanyahu will follow through with annexing, for example, the West Bank?
Yes. I mean, we have to be concerned about Trump and Netanyahu and others doing really outrageous things. They've done them in the past and they'll do them again, unless somebody checks them. And this is the missing element in this situation in Palestine and in U.S., Israel, U.S., Middle East relations. The Israelis, Netanyahu is quite desperate right now, so he's doing desperate things like this, only appealing to his right-wing fascist extremists in government and to their supporters overseas who don't know much about the details of the situation but emotionally respond to this kind of process where Israel is strong and protects itself and defends itself. Yes, we have to be careful about what might happen. The response has to be continued mobilization, protest, solidarity, and the justice for both Israelis and Palestinians simultaneously. That's the winning formula. And bring in Iran, and everybody will be on board happily, including the Saudis, too.
You, Abdullah Hamoud, are the first Arab American and first Muslim mayor of Dearborn. You have stressed that it's not only about a presidential election, it's about the local level. Can you talk about what this election means for you, for Rashida Tlaib of Detroit, outspoken supporters of Palestinians, of Lebanese, of against Israel's war on Gaza?
What you have heard over the last year is this community taking a principled position. This was the community in which the Uncommitted Movement was founded and blossomed organically across this country. But what you're hearing from many of our residents, from many of our constituents, from the anti-war, anti-justice movement, or pro-justice movement, excuse me, broadly speaking, is that this is a community that says, if we want to end gun violence and mass shootings in schools within the states, then we must also be willing to not provide a war criminal 2,000-pound J-bombs to decimate every school and university across Gaza. If we want to expand access to healthcare, then we also must be willing to hold to account any government that bombs or decimates every healthcare facility across all of Palestine or across Lebanon. These are the morals and the values that we have. And this is the principal position that we have taken. And this is not just a position that is popular here in the city of Dearborn, but if you look across the polls, across this country, you have seen that the center of America has moved on the issue of Israel and Palestine. And what has yet to be had is the center of the two major political parties in this country to move on the issue as well.
From Ashabaka, the Palestinian Policy Network, I am Yara Hawari, and this is Rethinking Palestine. Over the last year, Palestine has been irrevocably changed in ways that for many of us were once inconceivable. Since the beginning of the genocide, the Israeli regime has killed over 50,000 Palestinians in Gaza, an estimate provided by the Palestinian Ministry of Health, that includes over 6,000 unidentified bodies in the ministry's possession, an additional 10,000 assumed to be still buried under the rubble. Devastatingly, some will never be retrieved. Meanwhile, a July 2024 article in the Lancet Medical Journal on the importance of accounting for Gaza's fatalities argued that conservative estimate of total deaths in conflict scenarios equated to 4 indirect deaths per 1 direct death. By this calculation, Israel's genocide has likely resulted in the loss of over 250,000 Palestinian lives since October 2023. In addition, Gaza is now home to more than 42 million tons of rubble. These ruins include many people's destroyed homes, businesses, and essential public infrastructure. Relentless Israeli bombing has also released hundreds of thousands of tons of toxic dust into the air, with long-lasting and deadly consequences. 80% of schools and universities have been damaged or destroyed, and for the first time since the Nakba, Palestinian children in Gaza did not begin school this year. Concurrently, the Israeli regime and its settler community stole a record amount of land across the West Bank over the past 12 months. This theft has been accompanied by increasing violence against Palestinian bodies. Over 700 have been killed, 5,000 injured, and thousands more arrested, bringing the number of Palestinian political prisoners to nearly 10,000. Further north in Lebanon, the Israeli regime has expanded its assault and displaced over 1 million people in the space of days and killed over 1,800, including Hezbollah Secretary General Hassan Nasrallah. Israeli bombardments have continued to target neighborhoods and Palestinian refugee camps from the sky, while colonial forces began a ground invasion in early October 2024. Joining me on this episode is Tariq Makhlouni, board president of the Shabaka. We will be discussing 1 year on from the start of the genocide in Gaza and the acceleration of the Israeli settler colonial project in the rest of Palestine and beyond. Tariq, thank you for joining me on this episode of Rethinking Palestine.
Thank you for having me.
Tariq, in this introduction, I took stock of the devastating material consequences on the ground, and I said that Palestine has been irrevocably changed. What does that mean for you?
Thank you for this question, Yara. I mean, look, for Palestinians, it's impossible to go back to October 6th. The genocide is the bloodiest year for Palestinians. We haven't had this number of Palestinians murdered, including in the Nakba. The devastation that you just outlined at the beginning of the episode is one that will inform everything today. It will inform our politics, our thinking. It will inform how we wage the struggle. It will inform how we relate to our brothers and sisters in the Gaza Strip and where we go from here. There's no way for us today to think about what Palestinian liberation is without taking stock of the genocide that is still ongoing. And in many ways, that thinking is already taking place and is already evolving, but it will really have to sort of shape our struggle once the ceasefire is achieved and after the killing stops. We're still very much in the act of witnessing this genocide and attempting to stop it. So in that way, the reality of the past year has irrevocably changed us as Palestinians and as humans, and that will impact our struggle. But there's another bigger way in which this past year is sort of unprecedented in the way that it's shaped us or changed us. And that's in ways that are not only relevant to Palestine. It's changed the globe in the sense of showing the limitations of the post-World War II international order. And in terms of demonstrating the hypocrisies and the racism of Western liberal democracies or so-called democracies. And it's completely shattered the illusion that we're living in a world of multilateral governance. It's highlighted how important it is for us as Palestinians and as allies, as people who are hoping for a more equitable world order, to really engage with some of the issues that have surfaced over the past year. The fact that we can witness a genocide on our phones and not only allow it to happen, but also face the narratives that it is, you know, self-defense or important or view Western liberal democracies sort of abetted and armed, I think it really brings up global questions to the fore. And I don't think there's a way for us to go back to October 6th, either in a Palestinian context or in a global one.
Yeah, Tara, I fully agree. And I want to unpack some of that further. But, you know, as you were speaking, you said, you know, this has been the bloodiest year for Palestinians, including, you know, the year of the Nakba. And every day it does seem that things are more and more horrific than the day before. And a lot of people are asking, how on earth is that possible? How is it possible for Israeli soldiers to bomb time and time again hospitals, to force doctors and medical workers at gunpoint to leave their patients, to shoot children in the head, to bomb schools, to destroy, you know, every aspect of life in Gaza? And something that I've been thinking about a lot is this idea or this notion that Israel is unstoppable. And I think on the surface, it does sometimes feel that way. It feels that way in the face of this brutality, this cruelty. You know, we have this rogue state violating international law left, right, and center, wreaking havoc across the region. But I think that statement is untrue, and it obscures the responsibility of others, because in the reality, it can actually be stopped. There are countries that hold a significant amount of leverage over the Israeli regime, the US and Germany, just to name two. They could literally stop this, or at least disrupt it. And that's why I think it's really important that we don't fall into that narrative trap, because it also dismisses how we got here. It dismisses and disregards the decades-long impunity that Israel has managed to achieve for itself and has managed to cultivate. And it also dismisses that there are very real mechanisms of accountability that can be used.
I think that's absolutely right. And I want to say several points in response to this. I mean, on the first point around the insanity of witnessing this level of killing and of, you know, the disbelief, we're suspended in disbelief, you know, how and indignation, how could they kill at this rate in this way without stopping? And I think it's really important for us to sort of also take Zionism out of its exceptional mold. I think that genocidal regimes in the past have murdered and have killed in ways that are horrifying and brutal. And what we're seeing today is a particularly egregious example of that, because of the fact that we're witnessing it live on our screens, and the sense of time in which the immediacy of it is happening in front of us. That cracks the illusion that we might have sat in before October 7th, that, you know, had we known about these other genocides, maybe the world would have acted to stop it. And now we know that the world wouldn't have acted to stop them. Well, the reason I'm saying this is because this disbelief that we're in is also something that we need to sit in, and we need to understand how Israel is able to do what it's doing. I think the level of dehumanization has been so pervasive that I don't think they think that they're killing humans in Gaza. I don't think they regard Palestinians as human. And I think that is what enables them to continue this level of sadistic violence. There's no other way really to sort of think about some of the images that we've seen coming out of Gaza just this week. You know, the bombing of refugee camps, people being burnt alive. There's a sadism there that I think is driven by a complete internalization of the belief that Palestinians are not humans. Now, the reason I'm sort of bringing this up is because it relates to your point about whether Israel is stoppable or not. Israel is absolutely stoppable. I mean, if there's anything that came out of October 7th of Hamas's attack, is to sort of shatter this idea that Israel is invincible, that as a military power, that it can't be dismantled. As an apartheid regime, it can't be challenged. I think we've seen, not only through Hamas's attack, but from the reality that Israel would not have been able to wage this genocide without the US, that Israel absolutely is a state, is a settler colony that has always been and continues to be dependent on empire, dependent on the foreign metropoles that allow it to do what it is doing. And therefore, in that sense, it is stoppable. There are levers of power that can be used to arrest the kind of atrocities that Israel has been carrying out, you know, for a century, not Zionism for a century, Israel since 48, not just since October 7th. But the reason why it hasn't been stopped is because this dehumanization of Palestinians isn't limited to Israel. This is a Western dehumanization. Palestinians are not featuring, and I have to say, not just Palestinians, Arabs do not feature in the thinking of liberal, so-called liberal Western states, right? They believe that Israel is the banner of a civilizational project. They're fighting against barbarism. This has always been the underlying assumption or belief of Zionism, and it continues to be today one that also informs America's engagement in the region and America's engagement specifically with Israel. So this dehumanization is not limited to Israel. It extends far beyond that. And so when we're thinking about, you know, is Israel stoppable? The answer is, of course, it's stoppable, but there's no will to stop it. Because as far as countries like the US are concerned, Israel is serving their both their ideological and their strategic purposes. Now, I think that that's completely misplaced, and I do think there's a divergence of interests, but I don't think the American administration have woken up to that.
I don't think you're completely right. You know, the Zionist project and the Israeli regime has completely dehumanized Palestinians. There's no way that they could be doing what they're doing on such a massive scale and with such support from the Israeli public. You know, I think some polling showed that like over 95% of the Israeli public supports the genocidal actions in Gaza. And I think, you know, there's the only way they could be doing this is with such mass dehumanization, which, as you rightly pointed out, extends beyond the Zionist regime, right? It's been decades and decades of dehumanization of Palestinians and Arabs by the West and beyond. And as you were speaking, I was thinking in particular, because this is something that I have written on, in particular, the Western media's role in this genocide. And really, you know, what we're seeing and what's being highlighted over this year is that the groundwork and the foundations for this genocide were laid long ago through this consistent dehumanization. And the Western media, mainstream media, has a lot to answer for in this regard. We've seen it by the way that the Western media reports on the killing of Palestinians, how they consistently unchild Palestinian children, how they completely dismiss and delegitimize Palestinian voices. So I think there is a lot to be reckoned with there.
This is the Palestine Debrief podcast, a production of Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East and a proud member of the Harbinger Media Network. We discuss all things related to Palestine and examine how they intersect with the political landscape here in Canada and beyond. I'm your host, Wissam Sheikh Hassan. The genocide of Gaza uncovered aspects that were extensively different and perhaps even slightly clearer than previous aggressions. Media biases and their attempt to control the narrative is no doubt the largest part of it. The social media element and their extensive silencing and shadow banning of Palestinian content that was an extension of silencing Palestinian advocates in general. I mean, how many cases have we heard of people who have lost their jobs for speaking out? One such person who was punished for expressing solidarity for Palestinians was Paul Bigger, who was fired from the board of a company he founded, Circle CI, for releasing a blog post titled "I Can't Sleep," decrying what he saw, a massacre of Palestinians conducted by Israel, and supported by what he considered the overwhelmingly pro-Zionist tech venture capitalist industry. Soon after, he opened a Discord, which is an instant messaging social platform, that was later opened to the public and resulted in a coalition of tech folks who worked towards Palestinian freedom by disrupting conventional narratives, attempting to capture systems of power, and accelerate pro-Palestinian organizing and public awareness efforts, both online and offline. That resulted in Tech for Palestine. They have many technological tools, such as the media bias meter tool that measures biases in descriptions of Palestinians and protesters in the media, one that is used by CGPME, as well as other media organizations. Here to talk to us about the use of technology to counter how Israel spreads its message is the man himself, CEO of Tech for Palestine, Paul Bigger. Thanks for being with us.
Happy to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, the tools that you have incorporated in Tech for Palestine, I think it's one that we're starting to use at CGPME, is the media bias meter. can share more details about the tool and how it works.
So this is one of the projects that we've incubated and supported in Tech for Palestine. The Media Bias Meter provides analysis of particular media platforms. So it looks at, let's say, for example, the New York Times or the Globe and Mail in Canada, for example. And it looks through all of the articles that they've published throughout this genocide. And they say, how exactly are they reporting it? How are they talking about who gets killed versus who gets massacred versus who dies? Who is named in the attack? Are Hamas named? Is Israel named? And basically all of the ways that people use bias in headlines and in articles to, you know, take part in manufacturing this narrative in a one-sided way.
Yeah, I've read the article with the breach about they've used that tool in analyzing the student encampments in the Globe and Mail. And the question I have, do you think that monitoring and highlighting these media biases help create a meaningful change in the long run? Or are there limitations to the approach in shifting mainstream narratives about Palestine?
I think there's two sides to this. One is that in order to be able to counter something, you must be aware of it. You must be able to produce evidence of it. One of the things that we've learned over the last year is just how pervasive Israeli influence is. People have known for years about the influence of AIPAC in the United States or of the ADL in the United States as well. But I think people have really not put together this concept of Israeli Hasbara. So Hasbara is Israel's name for propaganda. And a good way to think about it is a distributed network, loosely coordinated, of people who just, you know, feel very strongly that Israel's narrative must be pushed. And, you know, sometimes they push it in their local school boards, their local town hall. Sometimes they push it in Congress, in the example of AIPAC. But wherever you have people who are very, very pro-Israel, people who are strong Zionists, then you have people pushing Israel's narrative and a Hasbara narrative. And in order to counteract that, you must first be aware of it. And then you must be able to see where it happens. And then you must find a way to address that and to counteract it. Now, to the part of your question of, like, does this work? You know, I think one of the things that we've seen, especially since Trump in 2016 and with Brexit, but I think we can also see this in the 90s and with things like manufacturing consent for the war in Iraq, is there are very few consequences for violating norms, for breaking the rules. The Israel over the last year has experienced almost no consequences for massive violent escalations, for a genocide. The politicians who have supported it in the United States, which is their most important ally and who pays for the whole thing, they have experienced very limited consequences. Newspapers who have really been extremely biased, such as CNN or the New York Times, have also experienced very little. You know, in some magazines' cases, like for example, The Atlantic has someone who was in the IDF and who actually has publicly admitted to torturing Palestinians. And not only does he remain as editor, but the Atlantic has experienced no consequences for that either. So we're really in a case where media certainly experiences very few consequences, and neither does anyone else. And that's kind of the world that we're in now.
Yeah, I mean, even in Canada here, the National Post has stated clearly that since they started, they have been, following a Zionist agenda. You know, I would assume if anybody were to come up and say, you know, I'm writing, you know, pro anything, any description you want to use, content, I mean, you
right.
can...
I think that a really good framing for this is the language that people use around spying. Is appropriate, right? These are assets that have been placed. These are, you know, people who are running influence campaigns. They are taking over the institutions that, you know, of our society, and they are putting an agenda that is biased towards a foreign government. And if this was Russia, people would be going to jail, right? You know, we'd be calling it spies and assets and treason, or if it was China or something like that. But instead, because it's Israel, again, no, you know, just no consequences for it.
Yeah. I mean, I understand why the work needs to be done, but then when you know that there is very little to what result that effort will bring, you feel...
I think it's important to remember that we are, you know, 60 years into Israel's campaign for influence in the West. maybe more. You could call it that we're 130 years into it. You know, the Balfour Declaration was 100 years ago, and that was a significant amount of influence had gone into making that happen. So with so much prep and such, I would say, disorganized counter Hasbro happening, you know, I don't think we could expect that in a year we are suddenly going to counter something that has been developed for so long and that is so mature in its assets and in its achievements. And I think what we are starting to see, though, is people are I would say, still in an early stage of waking up to seeing what's happening. The amount of Israeli influence does not sit well with Americans who are not Zionists. So we have something like, you know, less than 10% of the population who's vehemently pro-Israel. And the other 90% of the population is saying, like, wait, why did we ban TikTok? Like, what is that about? Why are we giving $20 billion to Israel to bomb civilians? Like, why is that? And I think that we are fundamentally, you know, the truth is on our side here. And the need is to organize better and to have more mature operations like this that expose it, because once it's exposed, people start registering their dislike.
I think I feel a lot of the work that pro-Palestinian tech companies, the importance of it comes in light of social media platforms censoring pro-Palestinian content, mm-hmm. restricting voices advocating for Palestinian rights. Is there anything specific that Tech for Palestine does to address these challenges of digital censorship?
Yeah, so a lot of what we're doing is into research into exactly how it happens. We work with a lot of the organizers of the pro-Palestine groups advocating around big tech. So No Tech for Apartheid, No Azure for Apartheid, Meta Stop Censoring Palestine, and other groups like this one are advocating specifically against those companies. And we are working with those companies. I recently gave a talk at the Tech Workers Coalition conference about Hasbro and how it happens, and sort of tying together a lot of different threads about the Hasbro that we see in media, like we just discussed, and the same Hasbro that we see within social media companies. So, for example, there's an article actually released today about the role of Jordana Cutler, who used to be a Likud party member and who is a very, very senior Meta person and who made the decision about taking down the Columbia SJP's Instagram account. And so that sort of thing where we expose how big tech has very senior people who are pro-Israel at LinkedIn. There's a guy called Tomer Cohen, who's their CPO. At Meta, their CISO is a guy called Guy Rosen. Both of these were in the IDF. There's Sheryl Sandberg, who used to be board member at Meta, who is currently on a pro-Israel propaganda tour to about her movie Screams Before Silence. There's, you know, the power of these people who are advocating for Israel, you know, the power that they already have within these social media companies is exactly why these policies are coming down the way they are. And these ludicrous policies that say, for example, you're not allowed to be anti-Zionist on the platform. You're not allowed to speak out about an ideology, or it's parallel with the ADL where they're promoting this ludicrous definition of anti-Semitism that says criticism of Israel is anti-Semitic. So these are, you know, a very, very well worked and mature organizations, and it is going to take time to cause problems for them and to poke holes in it and eventually to really to turn it around but I have a lot of faith that that with the organizing that's happening across the ecosystem that will eventually change.
Do you have any tools that counters misinformation about Israel and Palestine? I know there's one that's in Twitter, well, X, that's a community-driven fact-checking tool, the Birdwatch. Is there anything similar on that front that Tech for Palestine is working on or can incorporate into news?
So Birdwatch is an interesting one. That's called Community Notes now. I think anytime that you have a sort of a distributed way of changing people's or of adding information to things like Community Notes, it inevitably becomes weaponized. So Israel has thousands of people as well as probably hundreds of thousands of bots that weaponize any sort of tools like social media networks, like reporting, or the ability to flag posts on social media network. That's part of the suppression. And I feel that Community Notes, Birdwatch as it used to be known, is very much part of that as well. When you try to offset it or offload that work to the community, you end up with the biases of the community. And of course, the other problem is that when you don't try to offload it to the community and instead you offload it to policy, which is what Meta does, then you end up with biased policy. Some of the work that we're doing around that, we're supporting an organization called NewsCord, and that's newscord.org. And they do a lot of the same sort of social media bias that we were discussing for Media Bias Meter. But what they do instead is that they compare across news articles. And so that, you know, if there's a, you know, one particular article that gives forth one piece of news, say for example an attack on Beirut that happened last week, they will look at the articles that were written across different news platforms, and whether it's CNN or Al Jazeera, for example, and highlight, you know, over here they say one, over here they say another. But it's not that kind of social media thing. I think the social media thing is so widely weaponized that I think it's going to be really difficult to fight back against.
Just a note that the following story contains audio that is not up to the typical standards of the LJI Roundup. My apologies to our listeners. This week, Montrealers are hearing words of warning from the United Nations expert on Palestine. But will Canada listen? Francesca Albanese, UN Special Rapporteur on the Occupied Palestinian Territories, spoke to members of the press in Montreal on Sunday, her first of several speaking engagements in the city, with more to come across Canada. She called on the government to uphold its obligations under the Genocide Convention and use all possible political leverage against Israel, including an arms embargo and formal sanctions. Recall that Canada's current arms embargo is only partial and excludes a deal through which arms can be funneled to Israel through the United States.
I'm here as I was a few days ago before the General Assembly, reminding you and other member states to abide by international law. I'm not imploring for your charity. I'm not appealing to your morale. I'm asking you to respect international law, because this is what you are supposed to do.
Albanese is making the speaking tour mostly to the public. She told reporters that meetings with government officials have been cancelled, largely because of outside pressure. Albanese has been accused of anti-Semitism by prominent Zionist groups like the Center for Israel and Jewish Affairs, as well as individuals like Anthony Housefather, a Montreal MP and special advisor on Jewish community relations and anti-Semitism. Mostly at issue are remarks comparing Israel's actions with that of Nazi Germany. On Sunday, she deplored that Canada has been slow to recognize a consensus among independent experts that the conflict in Gaza is a genocide.
I'm not interested in debating and convincing why it's genocide. It's written in my reports and it's, again, unmissable. But a state which has a colonial past like this one has a heightened responsibility to clear the record with the past and to help colonial people liberate themselves from the yoke of colonialism. This is going to be an act of rehumanization both toward the Palestinians and the Israelis.
She reminded the audience that as a genocide, the conflict demands a certain response and certain obligations from countries like Canada.
The first action that should be undertaken by this government is to ensure maximum transparency through a 360-degree audit, revealing and ensuring clarity about all relations that Canada has with the state of Israel. from an economic, political, diplomatic, military, strategic point of view. Because any act of trading, buying, or selling connected to Israel's unlawful occupation, which is now resulting into the commission of atrocities, is going to entail responsibility for the Canadian government as well. And I don't think that this government wants to maintain this legacy.
The visit comes amid news that Israel has canceled its agreement with UNRWA, the UN agency responsible for aid to Palestinians, and a lifeline for the refugees in Gaza. Just last month, Israeli forces targeted UN peacekeepers in southern Lebanon as well. Albanese said she was fearful of what Israel's actions and the lack of international sanctions would do to the fragile system of international cooperation, and especially bodies like the UN.
I'm really worried. Right now, the system is failing politically, from a legal point of view, because when I hear again the security, there is no one other than us, independent experts, raising our hand and saying this is not self-defense.
Beyond pressuring governments to do more, she called on Canadians to stop shying away from terms like genocide and apartheid to describe Israel's actions.
The way you diagnose the problem determines the measures you identify to resolve it. And talking forever about Israeli-Palestinian conflict has confused the mind and has projected upon us this false equivalence between the Palestinians and the Israelis, obscuring and muting the reality that it might be a conflict, but it's a conflict between a colonizer and a colonized. Where is the army? Where is the Palestinian army? Again, I know that in this country, mentioning the word apartheid is a taboo. Why so? I mean, I can tell you why it's apartheid. I want to hear those who say, no, no, it's not apartheid. I want them to sit with me and tell me why. There are thousands of pages of human rights written by human rights organizations, Israelis, Palestinians, Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, and more, and universities, including Harvard University, documenting why it's apartheid. It's the most documented apartheid ever.
Albanese continues her cross-Canada speaking tour despite pressure campaigns for universities to cancel her talks. The talk to reporters on Sunday was hosted by Montreal's Ligue des Droits et Libertés. I'm Jules Bijal, reporting with the Local Journalism Initiative. Thanks for listening.
Do you believe that Israel has a right to exist?
Israel does exist. Israel is a recognized member of the United Nations. Besides this, there is not such a thing in international law like a right of a state to exist. Does Italy has a right to exist? Italy exists. Now, if tomorrow Italy and France want to merge and become Ita-France, fine, this is not up to us. What is enshrined in international law is the right of a people to exist. So the state is there, the state of Israel is there, is protected as a member of the United Nations. Does this justify the erasure of another people? Hell no. Not 75 years ago, not 57 years ago, surely not today. Where is the protection of the Palestinian people from erasure, from annexation, from illegal occupation and apartheid? This is what we need to discuss.
One year ago, everything changed. Gaza's voice pierced the world's indifference, and nothing has been the same since. It's been 1 year since Israel launched a devastating assault on Gaza, a genocide that has taken tens of thousands of Palestinian lives. Over 85,000 tons of explosives have rained down, surpassing the devastation of Hiroshima. Advanced weaponry and technology intensify the destruction, turning homes into rubble and wiping entire neighborhoods off the map. Israel's choked off access to food and water, inducing a man-made famine. The deliberate targeting of healthcare and sanitation has led to outbreaks of preventable diseases, the death toll has soared, with some estimates exceeding 300,000 Palestinians killed. Yet despite unimaginable hardships, Gaza continues to teach life.
They're taking away life, but I'm bringing it to earth.
Social media has illuminated their stories, showcasing the incredible resilience and humanity of the Palestinian people. Despite the attempts to eliminate them, their courage and steadfastness have touched hearts worldwide. It's ignited a global movement of solidarity years in the making. A new generation of activists has risen, believing that justice for Palestine is intertwined with justice everywhere. Gaza has become a rallying cry, a moment of no return. Until Gaza is free and its people can live in peace, nothing will be the same.
That's it for this hour. On today's show, we covered the U.S. election and its potential impact on Palestinians and Lebanese. We also talked about some of the reasons the genocide against Palestinians is able to continue with no signs of stopping. For example, we talked about the years-long campaign of dehumanization against Palestinians and Arabs, the complicity of the media and social media companies in spreading disinformation, and of course, the most important, the refusal of the international community to interfere to stop the crimes committed by the Israeli government. This unfortunately includes Canada, that has been called out recently by the UN Special Rapporteur of the Palestinian Occupied Territories, who is touring Canada at this moment to remind us that we have a responsibility to abide by international law, which Canada hasn't been doing so far. If you missed part of the show, you can go to CKUT's website and listen to it again. All the shows are archived on our page. Just click on the name of the show and you will find us. This was Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. My name is Sausan Kadura. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
life is better in the city. I like the way it don't know me. One, two, three!
The second Friday nights in the Recital Hall concert will be Cassador on November 22nd at 8 p.m. These shows at the Isabel are licensed,